New identities. She's a journalist, the co-founder of the feminist magazine Spare Rib, started that in 1971. She's also... 1972? Okay. Hopefully that's the first factual error and the only one. The former editor of British Esquire magazine. She's edited national newspapers, made television documentaries, written both non-fiction and fiction. But most recently, Rosie Boycott was appointed by the Mayor of London to help improve Londoners' access to healthy, locally produced and affordable food. And it's about food and its importance both to our own health and the health of this shared planet through its implications for climate change that we're going to be addressing and talking about this afternoon. Rosie, you're somebody who's you're somebody for whom issues and causes have been quite important in your life. And I'm interested to know, when did the idea of food and environmentalism become important to you?
Well, I think environmentalism has always been important to me ever since I was a kind of hippie and we cared about it, but then it went away. And food became very important and interesting to me when, after I left editing the Daily Express, and I started a farm in the West Country in England, and it was a slightly ramshackle small holding on which we had pigs and chickens and some goats and lots of vegetables. And I became very intrigued by all sorts of aspects of it. One, how little I knew. That was the first thing. I mean, that I knew absolutely nothing about how the food in our supermarkets and on our shops got to us, where it had come from, where it had been made. I knew nothing. I also became very stunned by the kind of magic of growing and the magic of vegetables, and that the realization that, you know, you plant a tiny seed and you look after it and it becomes this big plant that feeds you, but that essentially it's sunlight. It's just pure sunlight that's gone into those leaves, and that you and I eat them and then we derive that energy, or we eat them via the fact that we eat a cow who has eaten that, and that actually nothing in this entire world functions without that very, very simple relationship of photosynthesis happening. And the same is, I mean, oil is just 750 million years old, photosynthesis, pure sunlight in a jar. And that moved me a great deal and made me get very interested. And then, of course, I got very interested in global food systems, the fact that it's very insecure, where oil impacts on it, and all the rest of it.
But as an old-school feminist, did the idea of cooking, did you used to think of it as a way that men tyrannized women?
Absolutely, I did, yes. And when we started Spare Rib, we used to have... Well, I had a slogan, which was, don't type, don't cook, and you'll get ahead. We all, of course, learnt to type, because you couldn't get by without learning to type. But none of us cooked. And, in fact, we had a dishcloth that was given away in a very early issue, and it said, first you sink into his arms, then your arms end up in his sink. And that, in a sense, encapsulated what we felt about cooking. And that's a joke in one level, but it had a very significant effect, I think, both in America and in Europe, not my tea towel, but the kind of culture that represented, which was that during the 70s, for a start, the notion that you needed two-income households started to happen. The consumer economy started to happen. The first credit cards appeared. The first real mass amount of household gadgets to make cooking quicker, or actually to make cooking not necessary at all. And women stopped cooking completely and started to eat ready meals. And the idea, it was rather silly to cook, rather like non-feminist, rather like not being a liberated woman. And the result of it today is that in Britain, we eat 49% of all the ready meals that are sold in the whole of Europe. And what we didn't realize, I think, at the time, was that, of course, for a supermarket, there is only so much markup you can put on a piece of broccoli. It's kind of whatever it is, and you can't do much else with it. But the moment you turn that broccoli into a ready meal, then your prices are going higher and higher. And we were opening the door to that happening. And the other thing that was going on simultaneously was that the moment you started to produce the cheaper food, and that is a whole other story which we can come on to, back in, say, 1975, people spent around about a quarter of their family income on food. Today, it's around about 7%. And it's that gap that powered the consumer economy.
I'll pick up on that in a second, but just, do you think that women's liberation, or to use that word, or feminism, then played a role in the changing relationship that we have with food?
Definitely, definitely, because we didn't, we started to stand back from it, to say that this was something you kind of had to have, and that you would go to a shop and buy it instantly made. So the consequence of that was that you stopped cooking in the evenings. You maybe cooked at weekends. It started a process, not true in all households, but true in an awful lot, of a social breakdown. I mean, it's now reckoned in the UK that one in four households doesn't have a dining room table. I think when I was growing up, every house I knew had a dining room table. You sort of ate with your parents whether you wanted to or not. There was a kind of ritual to do with it, and you had some kind of conversation, pleasant or not. Now you find a lot of families where somebody will have pot noodles in front of the TV, another person will eat pizza up in their bedroom. And there was almost an idea, I think, in the 80s and into the 90s, that this was somehow quite cool and fashionable, that everyone snacked, and lots of adverts promoted the idea that you just cruised past the fridge and you took something out and you ate on your own. And that if you're going to, certainly what in the job I do now, and I work in a lot of areas where you would say there were serious food deserts, where the shops have no fruit, no vegetables. Well, they'll sell onions, but that's the lot. A third of the shop's devoted to alcohol, and the rest of it is really, really rubbishy meals. You'll find those households don't have dining room tables, and you'll also find a great deal of social breakdown there, and kids ending up on drugs, kids ending up unemployed, kids ending up in gangs.
So that's the story of what's been going on inside the family in the last 30, 40 years. What's been the story of what's happened to food in terms of increased production and decrease in price? How has that happened? And just tell us the story of how we've got to where we are now.
That's a slightly story that starts slightly earlier. And in both America and in England and in Europe, Western Europe certainly, not Eastern Europe, that's happened much later. After the war, when everyone had to rethink food because suddenly they wanted to get more self-sufficient, and we were left with a great deal of nitrogen after bomb making, and there was a lot left over. And that was turned into fertilizers. The most key thing that you need in your soil is nitrogen. If it can be natural, that's much the best. And you get that from, certainly in Britain, you get that primarily from clover. And so if you were recycling your crops properly, you'd plant clover, then you plant something else, and you take that. However, along comes nitrogen fertilizer, which is made from oil, which is fossil-based fuel, and you stick it on the soil, and suddenly the whole of farming changed completely, as I say, across America and Europe, because the crop yields went up by 5 to 6%. Suddenly, it was no point in having a farm where you kept pigs and goats and sheep and cows, and you grew barley and you grew rye and you grew potatoes and you grew a bit of this and a bit of that. It was a very healthy farm in terms of its soil, but it was a very lousy farm in terms of its cash yield. So you ripped the whole farm apart, you took out the hedges, you made these enormous fields that went on for literally miles, and certainly if you go drive across the American Midwest, you can find fields that are sort of 50 to 60 miles big. And you then grew the monocrop, and you kept it going year after year by just giving it more and more and more fertilizer. So suddenly, from people being self-sufficient in small units, you became absolutely concentrated on one production. And the result of it was that the soil started to weaken greatly. And you therefore had to keep adding increasing amounts of nitrous fertilizer. We didn't stop there, because as agriculture turned into agribusiness, and you got the few companies like Archer Daniels and Smithfield Foods and literally starting to take over the world, they looked at the world as their own breadbasket. So was it actually better and cheaper to grow things across the middle of Africa, to rip up the rainforests and grow things there, and a whole new world that bears no relationship whatsoever to the farming we used to know was on our lap. And in Africa, indeed in South America as well, the long-term effects of massive amounts of fossil fuel fertilizers on the soil has left the soil so damaged and so crumbly, because actually soil is one of the more magical things. I mean, it's extraordinary that we have gone off and explored space, but in fact, that 6 inches underneath the soil contains twice as many species as live on the top of the whole world. And they are very, very tinily bent together. And it's now so loose that soil from Africa has been found blown all the way to South America. And South American soil is found in Hawaii. It's lost its traction.
But the irony is that increased production has led to lower costs, but the more food that we've had, actually it's the nutrients have decreased in it, haven't they?
They have indeed decreased. So we start adding our own nutrients. I mean, milk is a very good case in point, as the cows, and they take, particularly this works with the Friesian cow, which is the black and white cow, and they have been inbred and inbred and inbred, so that now certainly the cows we have and the cows you get in Europe, they stand almost 6 feet tall at the shoulders, and they're really, really thin. They look like they're starving, like a sort of their bones all jut out, but their udders are like that. Every single part of the energy of the cow goes into making that udder full, and they milk them 3 times a day, and they produce around about, I think it's 6 times as much as an ordinary cow. However, their lifespan and their production span is less than 18 months, whereupon their dog food. So they have a pretty grim life, and you see them barely able to walk with these udders that weigh a vast amount, and it's they've turned them as near as possible. This is a cow that has been turned into a machine. It bears very little resemblance to something that used to love life and love being alive.
What about if somebody was put the other point of view, which is say, well, I can now buy food that's very, very cheap. I can go to a supermarket and have endless rows of different choice. I can get fruits, doesn't matter what season it is, I can get any fruit I want. I mean, what's the harm in that? That sounds great.
Well, to some level, there is no harm in it, except that what you're getting is become increasingly unhealthy. You're getting food that is prepackaged, that is full of additives, too much salt, and the wrong kinds of fats, called trans fats. Now, some fats that are off healthy meat, say, are actually fantastically good for you. Some fats are very bad for you and encourage heart disease. And they will come both in the fats that are used to kind of glue a ready meal together, but they're also in the fats that are left in chickens that are reared on a single sheet of A4 paper, roughly, as their space. They will be killed after 35 days. They are artificially fattened. They are fed with antibiotics. They move so little, and they fatten so fast that, in fact, in most cases, their leg bones break, and they end up living most of their life lying in their own feces and their own urine. Their feathers have all fallen out, and then they are pretty brutally killed. The fact that they haven't moved means that their fats have never at any point been able to develop. So when you buy free range, there is actually a reason beyond the fact that it tastes better. It's also better for you.
And there is a obesity crisis that's at least half the world is dying from.
No. The obesity crisis is quite extraordinary. The 2 billion people now are reckoned to be obese, and 2 billion people every day are malnourished and starving. And we in the West now have so much food, and I think we have such a big disconnect from food that we think of it as a factory product. Therefore, we'll buy as much of it as we want. And our bodies may still actually, to be healthy, want to have a diet that is much nearer a kind of hunter-gatherer diet, because in evolutionary terms, we've hit this kind of diet very, very fast. So actually to eat lots of vegetables, lots of nuts, bit of meat, is kind of what keeps us really healthy. What we're eating now is masses of white flour, masses of fats, masses of sugars, all sorts of things that we weren't meant to eat, and we're eating them in spades. In Britain now, 26% of kids entering school at 5 are overweight or obese. In New York, it's 36%, and those figures are rising. And those children now stand an 80% chance of being really, really fat adults. And, you know, with that comes not just the health problems of diabetes, heart attacks, strokes, etc., but crippling psychological problems to be fat in a culture that every single magazine throws at you. You should be thin. So there's an enormous cost that's not just about the cost on the health department of helping to keep people better, but an emotional cost, which is actually heartbreaking, because kids kind of wander into that. And the trouble is about all those tastes is they actually set up their own kind of addiction, because you don't really feel full if you stuff yourself with white bread and crispy things like that. So you want more, and you keep wanting more. And once you get your stomach big, you want more all the time.
And isn't one of the problems with trying to send this message out that food is not honestly priced?
Well, food isn't honestly priced, because the one calorie of food that gets to us has taken 10 calories of energy, i.e. oil, to get to us. And That sounds like a huge amount, but if you break it down from the farm machinery in, say, in Britain's case, the farm machinery being used in Kenya, the levels of fossil fuel fertilizers, the transportation, the packaging, the moving it to the supermarket, that is actually what one calorie of food really costs. While we have no price on carbon, while we have situations where the last summit in Copenhagen failed to deliver that, it is a cost that can be hidden within the manufacturer's cost. It's a tax-deductible cost, and it's called transport, and it goes down as a write-off. And the other thing that within it that is actually very cruel and inhuman is that a lot of those costs are fixed costs, but the human bit, which is the labor, is the one that's always squeezed. And I went a couple of years ago, I was in South Africa, going through the apple farms, where the women who actually plant the apples, weed them, do everything to them and pick them, they get 4% of the price of what we pay back in the supermarkets. You can always squeeze it. And for that 4%, you can't even afford to buy a protective garment to shield you from the harmful effects of the pesticides that you're putting on. And you're putting loads of pesticides on. I mean, they reckon an apple's had 25 different kinds of pesticides on it before it's got to you. And to me, that's horrific. I mean, it's like how ignorant we are about cotton. I mean, I'm wearing cotton, so I can't... It's difficult to say this, but I mean, cotton uses more fossil fuel fertilizers and dangerous pesticides than any other crop in the world. I mean, it has ruined the whole of Lake Baikal. Indian farmers, because they get so in hock for buying the seeds and the fertilizers. You know, the suicide rate among Indian cotton farmers is incredibly high. And you hear the terrible horror stories. And one I heard the other day about a farmer who'd been out and he had his protective kit for spraying, and he'd come home to the hut where he lived, and he put his coat on top of the hut so that it wouldn't be near his children. And it rained in the night, and it rained through the pesticides onto his children, and they were both dead in the morning. And that's a completely true story, which none of us want to know. We talk about things like pure cotton, like it's some sort of magical substance. Actually, it's seriously dirty.
And I think that story is a really good demonstration of the fact that everything is interconnected. And in a way, so much of us just take for granted the food that we get on the table or the clothes we wear, not thinking about the chain or the journey that each of them have taken.
Well, all of those things take very, very strange journeys. I mean, a pair of jeans, for instance, will the cotton will be grown in one place, it will be sewn in another place, and there's a town in China which makes 75% of the world's zips, which means if we think of, I don't know how many people are in here, 500 or so, that means roughly 420 of us, if we've all got zips, they were all made in the same town in China. And it's quite a spooky thought. And you do get the sense that's sort of too big to fail. But food has, you know, the same thing. It's got that enormous sense of connection to where things are grown now, given how global it is. So when you buy something that says, for instance, pork product, it says made in Britain, what the made in Britain might mean is that it was sort of turned into pork something or another and put in a box, right? That's the made bit. The pork itself could have been grown in Poland, the pig. But the pig food will have probably come from the rainforest, from the Amazon rainforest, where the soya will have been grown using all sorts of different, again, chemical things. And so it's very, very difficult for anyone to follow that chain. And one of the things that I am working on at the moment is to try to get ensure a total transparency. At the moment, the transparency of food is very thin, but if big companies were forced to put on, even if they put that onto the web, because you'd never get it onto the packaging, exactly where you followed the food back, you would get a sense of the just where this has been and where this has come from. I mean, it's very easy to get deluded by made in Britain, and you think, oh, that's okay.
It's like identifying the problem as a global problem and then thinking about solutions. Some of the solutions you've been thinking about and have been working on in London are very local, aren't they? They're in terms of owning the means of your own production and also kind of having a different relationship, which is a much more intimate relationship with the food that you're eating.
Well, I think that people need a more intimate relationship with the food they're eating, as well as with lots of things that they do. I had a friend who ran a very big London advertising agency, and sort of when great big global brands started to take over, whether you're talking about Coca-Cola or Jaguar or Louis Vuitton or Rolex watches, that he always referred to them as the fourth world, and that these were the brands that were kind of uncatchable, but everybody wanted to buy into them. And he said, and the human response to that is to go home and make your own marmalade, as though you get so scared by not being able to grab these things. They're too far away from you. And I think that that's beginning to happen with food, a sense that you don't know anything about it, but you're beginning to get aware that a lot of people are getting ill, and that, you know, maybe our bodies are worth a bit more than all this rubbish. And so growing your own and doing your own thing has become increasingly attractive. And it is a fantastic way to get people, A, to understand that food's rather magical, not rather magical, amazingly magical, and that it's important to you what you do with it, and it's important what you eat. And you and I were talking earlier, and that's something that I'd written that came out in London on Thursday, day before yesterday, was based on a survey where a lot of people and a lot of children were asked a number of questions, like very straightforward questions about food, and 43% of them thought that bacon came from sheep, and a huge amount of them thought that
oats.
Yeah, that muesli and oats grew on trees. Quite how it grew on trees, but something like 70% of them thought that, oh, there were trees that you shook them, and then the muesli just fell into bags underneath. And that's very sad, but it's also, if you don't know what you're doing, then how, A, can you keep yourself healthy, and B, how will you respect the planet? Because the question of food sustainability is actually very serious, and it isn't taken seriously enough. It is, the British government is now waking up to the idea that we are an expression that's called nine meals from anarchy. And what nine meals from anarchy means, that if you suddenly had a total oil crash, something went drastically wrong with all the Channel ports, I mean, somewhere or another, the imported food that we need couldn't get in and couldn't move around, that it would only be nine meals, literally like 3 days of no food, before you would be in anarchy. And that the fact that we are so dependent on this very complicated long chain is another reason I think people want to know more about it and make some of their own contribution to it, and certainly not throw so much away, which is another big element.
I want to pick up on that in a second, but I want to get back to the... Tell me a little bit about these specific things you're doing in terms of, like, for example, with schools and gardens as ways of kind of bedding in some of these ideas about relationships.
Well, we do a lot in London now. We just launched a competition a couple of weeks ago to get vegetable gardens into every primary school. That's 2,300 in London. 400 have got gardens. Because actually a garden is terrifically cheap to plant. You can do it for a few hundred quid, if that. You can also stick it in a small area. You don't need masses of space like you might need for a sports field. And you can also have it mobile. That's the other great thing that I think is a big mindset. I mean, we put gardens into old decommissioned skips. Skips are things that we have on the streets where people put their rubbish and they're vast. And we put gardens into builder's bags that are like that. And if someone wants to move them, you pick up the garden and walk. And the children then start growing. And in the schools that really get behind it, and we've got that happening in some areas as well, they're cooking the food as well themselves. And then they're going home and they're actually starting to get their parents to change their attitudes. Because I think somehow we've sort of lost a generation, but that we can re-find it through kids who love getting their hands dirty. And it is also like, it's a really good science laboratory for a school that hasn't got one. I was opening, when I opened the schools competition, and we were planting broad beans, and the beans were beginning to get very limp because the leaves were sprouting from the top and the roots were coming out of the bottom. And this very sweet kid called Ahmed, who was with me and we were planting, and he said, "What's that?" pointing at the bean. And I said, "Well, that's the broad bean." He said, "Well, why is it like that?" And I said, "Because it's provided the food to get this far. Now you've got to put it in the soil and it'll get the food from the soil." And he said, "Oh, my God, that's just so amazing." I mean, and it's very lovely when you see that.
And are you hoping that the kids start pestering their parents that they want some fresh food?
Well, according to the National Farmers Union of Great Britain, who did a survey of kids and this, they said that it's a figure that I find a bit hard to believe, but they swear that it's true. 93% of kids, if you get them growing their vegetables, they'll start to say to their parents, "Actually, I'd like to eat vegetables." And then they start to get a sense of, "I'd like seasonability, and I'd like it not to be something that's clearly come from abroad." Not that they understand concepts like embedded water, which I think is going to become very, very important in the food system. But, I mean, we have to know, and I'm sure it's true for lots of things here in Colombia, but if I buy a green bean that has been grown in Kenya. It's not just a question that I've used Kenyan labor to get myself this cheap green bean in January when I can't grow one myself. I am also stealing Kenya's water. And more in the environmental movement now, as water becomes really, I think probably, I used to think oil would be the first big crisis, but it's almost definitely now going to be water. The whole question of embedded water is getting huge, and there are a lot of movements to see whether on labels, you know, where you put calorific values, you also start to quantify embedded water. And just in this last summer, I mean, we've seen in Turkey, they dammed the head of the Euphrates to take more water off into that arable land up in Turkey because there were a lot of droughts. That led to a major drought in Iraq, major crop failures there, which has just added to the misery of that country. The price, food price spike of the year before last was a direct result, A, of the crop failures in America due to droughts, and the massive problems that they had in Australia when the Murray Darling, which is the main water source, dried up almost completely. Over a period of 7 years, this drought lasted, and people lost orange orchards that had been there for, 50 to 100 years. They lost vines, and it got to a point at the end of 2008, just before the rains came, when the Australian government was on the point of declaring Adelaide the first climate change failed city, because the water was running out, and they were saying, going to say that there could be no water use for industrial reasons and it could only be used domestically. So it's very, very scary where we are with water. And China is, of course, very, very watertight. And China only has 7% of China is agriculturally viable anyway. And so all their cattle are grown and reared in the rainforest and then brought back to China on a daily basis.
You were talking before about sustainability and that, you know, the system as it is isn't sustainable. How long can it carry on then?
It will carry on depending on what we do with our diet is the key thing in this. There is enough food for the world, regardless of the fact that we go to...
At the price that we're paying?
No, I don't think necessarily at the price that we're paying, but we can certainly grow enough to feed, well, certainly everyone we've got now, and certainly up to the 9 billion. It's to do with the distribution of food. It's to do with the fact that we in the West... A, we throw away a vast amount, 33% is reckoned in the UK, and the figure applies to America, is just chucked out because the yogurt's past its sell-by date, the beans are the whatever, and we hurl them in the bin without thinking about it. And we are seduced in supermarkets and Walmarts by two for the price of one. And again, they always tend to be for the most fattening thing that you can imagine. They're never for bananas. They are always for very... fattening chocolate biscuits, to which I've fallen foul several times. But the key thing is that if we ate like Americans who eat meat, bacon, sausages for breakfast, meat for lunch, meat for dinner, according to the World Health Organization, we would need five planets to feed the world as we see it. And it is meat that is at the bottom of a lot of these problems. It is still a universal social belief that the richer and more advanced you are, the more meat you eat. It somehow seems to be unbudgeable from human nature, and that human nature extends into China, where the consumption of meat used to be 2.5 kilos a year and is now rising to about 30, and it's going up like that, and similar patterns are emerging in India. We cannot do that. We are absolutely incapable of producing that many animals in however ghastly conditions we do it. We cannot all, but Americans are eating hundreds of kilos a year, so it's still a big gap, which of course the Chinese use when they're in climate change talks in terms of what their carbon footprints are, because to feed yourself through meat is very, very inefficient. I mean, if you eat beans or you eat lentils, you're taking that direct, where I started, sunlight energy from that to me, nobody in between. But the moment you stick it through a cow, you've also got to feed that cow and work it out. And there was always this statistic bandied around. I mean, it takes 2 kilos of grain to get a kilo of chicken, 5 kilos to get a kilo of pork, and then 7 to get a kilo of beef. But quite recently, the University of Manitoba looked at that statistic and said, actually, that applies to the entire cow, ears, tongue, feet, etc. But what does it actually mean if we want to say 1 kilo of edible beef? And the answer was it's 20 kilos of grain. So it's a fantastically inefficient way to feed the planet. So there has to be a big cultural shift about the way we eat. And then we will be all right. And I think a cultural shift about the way we look at GM.
I'm going to pick up about that in a second, but this big cultural shift, does that basically mean less choice and more expensive food?
Not at all, because meat is expensive, so you're going to eat less of it. Lentils and beans are incredibly cheap, and you're going to eat more of them. Where the cultural shift has to come is in the way we learn to cook, in the way we teach people about food, in the way that we say that. I mean, I think most people think that lentils and beans are rather a bit dreary and are sort of eaten by people who kind of can't afford to go out and buy a grouse or something like that, whether they want the grouse or not. So a whole new way of thinking has to come into play to make that possible.
And how much can this be done without government support? Is this stuff that individuals and families can do, or does it essentially need, you know, the governments to kind of back it?
Lots of it can be done on an individual level, but we won't change it all, because I think it's the same as where we are now in climate change, which is that we have voluntary codes of emissions reductions, and they have proved to be nigh on useless. And there's a world of commerce and new green technology waiting for the moment that legally binding targets go on to countries. Because the moment that happens and they're there, countries are going to have to change the way they create energy. They are going to have to look at a whole new system of doing it. And into that mix will come the way we produce food. That the one calorie of oil, one calorie of food to 10 calories of oil, all those things, a whole lot of other things will start to happen.
In terms of the binding agreements you mentioned about climate change, that's quite hard when there's a significant minority that are sceptical about climate change being man-made. That makes the presidents and the prime ministers, it binds their hands to some extent, because some of their voters don't support the idea that it is man-made and therefore we need to do anything.
Yes, and there's a very big school of thought, and certainly a lot of people in the United Nations who say that actually the democratic political systems are and will be incapable of dealing with climate change, because they have to go home and get elected. And, you know, being in Copenhagen, waiting for Obama to arrive, and, you know, great excitement. But then at the same time, knowing that 43% of America don't believe that climate change is man-made, that is not much of a mandate to go into talks that are already extremely tough for a country that is whose architecture and city structure is based entirely on the two or three or four car family. Your hands are very tied. And interestingly, the UN, you know, are now saying that even the UN really can't deal with it. And people often talk about saying that, well, you know, you make agreements like agreements that were made after the world wars, like the Bretton Woods Agreement. But of course, that's not true, because then you were coming out of disaster and you could see the ruins all around you. This time, it's in the future. And there is no historical precedent for this. We've never had to do this, to legislate and to think about something that is outside our time. Maybe not completely outside our time, but certainly outside our time. And you always look at the targets, and they're always at least 10 or 12 or 20 years away. They're never within the remit of any actual politician at the time. I feel that what happened at Copenhagen this year, we lost a year completely until Mexico in December. And given the weight of climate change denial and climate change skepticism, which is very high on the agenda at the moment because of the leaked Essex emails, and then again because of the document about the glaciers, which has got the IPCC into such trouble. And there is the people who disseminate that stuff and who help flag it up are on the whole the oil companies, who spend a vast amount of money, who are literally now in this, they're fighting for their lives, and they know it, so they'll throw anything at it to just create enough doubt to just stop people being confident. And I think that the scientific community and the environmental community is, on the whole, not good at responding fast, getting in there quick, and saying, actually, at the end of the day, yes, maybe that wasn't quite right about the glaciers, but they are melting. And evidence of what the snowmelt is doing is there for anyone to see right now, in that large parts of northern India are having extreme difficulty with their crop growing because water's rushing down at one minute, rainfall patterns are changing, and this is happening. It may take longer. It doesn't change the big picture. But in fact, what's happened, it's been allowed to distort the big picture.
And isn't it also a problem that political leaders find it quite hard to preach or say to people, you must eat this, or we'd rather you do this, because it smacks of paternalism. It smacks of a sense that, you know, the government telling me what I can do, what it can put in, you know, the minister telling me what I can put in my lunchbox. And politicians are a bit wary of that, aren't they?
Politicians are really wary of it, but at the same time, you do put politicians in place because you want them sometimes to take some tough decisions for you. And, I mean, politicians have taken the decisions to say, you can't smoke anywhere in Britain, you can't smoke anywhere in America, except in Las Vegas. You can smoke there, I gathered. Someone, a friend, went there the other day. And we have put things in for the sake of people. And, yes, there's a level where you can say it's a nanny state, but if you put in on a worldwide basis, I say the legally binding agreements, you would see that actually the market forces would pick up behind it. And the green energy companies would realize that they can get the big contracts. These big contracts would come into the developing countries so that the, at the moment, perceived unfairness between being asked to sacrifice development while the Western world, you know, has had all the goodness, or goodness, that's a debatable point, but had the benefits of development, would go away, because they would get fantastic development at a great speed. It would just be of a, you know, it's the second industrial revolution that we are looking at. And at the moment, it is kind of halted, because until you get the price on carbon, who's going to do it? It's like looking at all the oil companies, the coal-fired power stations. At the moment, there is no financial incentive to put carbon capture and storage onto any of the ones that say they're building daily or weekly in China. And so they emit carbon into the atmosphere at tremendous rates. The technology is there. Everybody knows what to do. It costs a bit. It's not that much. And it would all change like that.
In terms of your own, when you're out there campaigning and working with the mayor, do you feel that this is something which is going to capture the public mood, or is there a danger that it's essentially a middle class revolution that you're working to at the moment, and that the mass people have not yet been convinced?
Do you mean in the food thing,
and also in climate change? I mean, are these causes? I guess I'm trying to draw a parallel between feminism and this movement, in the sense that, do you feel like this is something where you can get a mass army of people to be growing their own food and to be campaigning for climate change, or do you think that essentially it's going to be a minority, but then there'll be a tipping point and things might break through from there?
Growing your own food is much less of a class issue than I thought it would be, and the absolutely most inspiring examples I've seen on it have been on very, very rough London estates, where women and elderly people have been really quite afraid to come downstairs into the kind of yards in the middle of these concrete high-rise tower blocks, because there's a gang culture that's going on, who, you know, at the minimum are going to jeer at them, and at the maximum are going to nick their bag. And that by putting gardens, again, mostly in builders' bags or in built raised beds, it's started to change the culture, and it's made people have a sense of ownership of the place. It's got tidied up. Those ghastly areas with old tin cans have disappeared. And I was on one such estate not that long ago, and I was talking with some of the local police, and they said that this little gardening project, which had cost the grand total of 2,000 quid, has done more than putting five bobbies on the beat to make this estate safe. So on one level, it goes right across. But you're right in the end that it's very easy to get those things lost in a world of farmers' markets, which are posh and have expensive food. I always think that the Prince of Wales is a very double-edged sword when he comes into this one, because, you know, he goes on about sort of organic food and gives it an aura that it is much more expensive and more difficult to grow. And I personally thought that flying all the way to Copenhagen in a private plane with 20 people to give a cocktail party for 45 minutes was not particularly cool. And he could have beamed himself in on a video link if it would have looked a lot better from an environmental point of view.
I mean, the other thing I was just talking about, the thing you were talking about in the community and what have you, is growing food and eating and the whole social dimension. One of the things that's quite interesting is that people do crave connections, don't they? And so much now is virtual, whether it's the internet or whether it's Twitter or whether it's Skype. And there is something quite magical about creating something from nothing with cooking, but it's also something quite magical about eating around a table and having social interaction. And in a sense, that's one of the ways I would suggest that you can win that battle, because it's about real communication and sort of reclaiming reality in a way.
Well, that's very much true. And you do find that if you've grown something, you're really reluctant to throw it away. And you want to cook it and you want to share it. And there was a little boy in a school in the summer, and they just put a garden in. And I was there on a Tuesday, and he was planting some tiny little carrot seeds. And he said to his teacher, he said, can I have it on Saturday? Because I'm going to see my aunt. And it was very, very endearing. I mean, it was like, my God, does he think it's going to come up by Saturday? But the fact that he wanted to take this thing that he'd grown as a gift. And so, yes, it does work. And I mean, we've got things running in England. We've got a thing called the Big Lunch that happens in July. And last summer was the first summer, and we got 1 million people to have lunch with each other. And they had to bring something that they'd grown. And they had to also try in their area to find someone who was essentially alone, like an elderly person who was a widow or a widower, and bring them along to the feast. And this year it's going to be our London, big London thing, and it's going across the country. And France has adopted it, parts of America have adopted it, Scandinavia has adopted it. It sort of went boing. And it is very nice, that sense that you can bring a community together around growing. I mean, that's what always used to happen, whether it was around the allotment or wherever, people got together, and they do get together around these community projects.
I got quite excited a couple of weeks ago, because I like falafel, and I normally go to this particular Lebanese restaurant to eat falafel. And then my girlfriend said, why don't we make it one night? And we made it, and I made it with my own hands. And I got so excited, I took a photograph of it on my mobile phone. And
of your falafel?
Yes. And every time I meet anyone, I show them a photograph of the falafel I cooked.
Well, it's nice. It's an alternate than a pet.
It's a sense of ownership. We've got about 15 minutes or so. Let's just see if there's any questions, and if there are, we'll throw it open to the audience, and if there aren't, then I've got a whole bunch of other questions that I can ask. So maybe we can, I don't know if the lights
can
come
the lights
up or whatever.
A bit. Can't see it's anything.
I just see a sea of darkness at the moment, so I can't tell if anyone's put their hand up. I can see somebody waving in the second row to that side there. You could probably just shout. Slowly the lights are emerging. Okay. So we can get a microphone to the lady on the second row on this side, please.
That's not me, down there first.
Come further up, second row, yeah.
Hi.
Hi.
It frustrates me when I do my shopping that you can see that we're importing, say, potatoes, but then we're also importing potatoes, and those are the ones that we receive in the supermarket. Shouldn't there be some kind of regulations in place? Are there, and shouldn't there be, if there aren't?
That's a really good question, and it's not just potatoes. We send exactly the same amount of chickens to Holland every week, apparently, as we get from Holland, and there's an enormous amount of just mad duplication of things moving around the world in really random ways. And I think the problem is that, certainly again in Europe and certainly in America, that unlike a lot of things that are totally essential to life, or, I mean, you could say food is the most essential thing to life. I mean, it has always, since time began, been in the hands of the private market. You know, unlike things like, you know, education or health or whatever that democratic governments have thought they ought to look after, it's been somehow very handy to just give food away. And the truth is that people don't really know how the food systems work, and it's one of those odd things that the more you learn, the more you stumble over completely stupid oddities like that there's food travelling backwards and forwards. And I mean, in England as well, we catch fish in Cornwall, we pack the fish in Yorkshire, which is 300 miles away or so, and then we drive it all the way back to Cornwall. I mean, mental, completely mental. I don't think that governments will necessarily do anything about that. I think that that is something, again, that if you get a price on carbon, if the real cost of what it costs to move really starts to impact, companies will say, we can't afford this, and they'll start to change it. But it's difficult otherwise to get at. It's just crazy, though.
Great. Okay, has anyone else got a question?
Yeah, there's three.
I can see somebody at the front there. Is anybody up there?
Yeah, there's a lady up there in the middle.
Okay, let's go for that. Where did you see Rose?
You see that he's gone just past it. There's a lady in a green dress up the middle of the aisle. Okay,
let's go. Yeah, let's go for the lady in the green dress first, and then we'll go to the guy because Rosie did spot.
Yes, hello. My question is about genetically modified foods. To me, it's a great problem because even if you want to make falafel, you go to the shop to buy your beans, and it doesn't say on the package whether it's genetically modified, grown with genetically modified seeds, and I suspect it probably is. And even to grow your own food then, you'd probably want to buy foods that are not grown from genetically modified seeds. Do you think this is a problem, or this is not, to you, a problem?
Well, I think that the problem in genetically modified foods is called Monsanto. And it is not actually the problem of breeding a seed with a seed to create something that might survive better in a sandy condition and survive, you know, be able to deal with salt water, which is going to become an enormous issue in a lot of lowland Indian farms and in Bangladesh and countries like that, where already the tiny bits of sea level rises that we're experiencing are beginning to go into areas and causing, you know, plants need to grow in salty water, which they're not, you know, they're not geared up to do. And so there's a lot that clever plant breeding needs to achieve, which, and after all, if you think about it, we have been breeding plants forever. We've been trying this and that to make that kind of apple. I mean, a nectarine is half of a peach and half of a plum. I mean, it's within us. What's gone wildly wrong and began to go wrong under George Bush, who let go and the idea that there should never be... I mean, there used to be a kind of unofficial code of conduct that said that people should never be able to take patents on life. And what was granted to Monsanto was the idea that you could take a patent on life. And so they now own 11,000 patents, and virtually no other companies get a look in. And the most horrible thing they do is to produce the Terminator seed. Do you know about that? I mean, which is, I mean, for the sake of anyone else who doesn't, a Terminator seed is what, when you sell grain, traditionally a farmer will plant grain, oats, wheat, whatever, and then he'll keep enough back for his seed bank for the following year's harvest. When you have a Terminator seed, it turns out that the plant is sterile, and that while you can eat the ears of wheat, the whatever, you cannot plant it again, it won't go. So you have to go back to the source and you have to buy more. So in other words, you are hooked into constantly making one company richer. And that is absolutely terrifying and completely against all kind of decent codes of living, and that's been allowed to get run away with. But I do think that, I mean, I hope that somehow Monsanto comes an enormous cropper. I can't quite see how it's going to happen at the moment, because levels of genetically modified food are probably going to be needed. And again, if we go into, you know, increasing drought in different places, increasing water shortages, plants that can survive with very little is good, and also, you know, some degree of pest resistance, because otherwise, you know, plants, and especially crops like potatoes, they can vanish overnight. And again, this is somewhere where Monsanto has been devilishly clever, because they own the companies that make Roundup as well, so they produce seeds that are what's called Roundup ready, and therefore you're locked again into a kind of Monsanto cycle. So it seems to me it's a problem of, it's a hideous problem of capitalism run riot rather than the problem of the science.
Okay, so...
But you're quite right, by the way, about the labelling. The labelling is extremely bad, and that should be legislated in exactly the same way that there's legislation now that says you have to put calorific content on, you have to put salt content, you have to put sugar content. You should also have to put GM content.
There's a guy at the front and then the young man about three or four rows behind him on the same side.
Aceptando...
Hang on.
Aceptando, por supuesto, el tema del cambio climático y el impuesto al CO2, ¿no cree que hay un problema subyacente en la alimentación del ser humano y es el exceso o la sobrepoblación en el planeta? Y segundo, ¿no habló usted de los subsidios?
Hang on, just stop. This one's working. Okay,
¿Otra vez? Again?
Yeah, I'm really sorry, I've only just connected into you. Could you
stop? Aceptando el problema grave de cambio climático y que el impuesto a las emisiones de carbono son una necesidad. El problema subyacente es la sobrepoblación en el tema de la alimentación. De ese tema usted no se refirió y quisiera conocer su opinión. Igualmente, en segundo lugar, me gustaría escuchar lo que usted opina de los subsidios que los países desarrollados le dan a sus agricultores, porque podríamos terminar fácilmente con los alimentos desarrollados en los países industrializados, enviados a estos países, o a China o a India, esas gallinas que crecen en esos espacios o las vacas locas que arrancaron en Gran Bretaña.
I've started the other end, start with the subsidies. I mean, I think subsidies are really, really difficult in certain areas. For instance, the US government still gives massive cotton subsidies to the cotton farmers in the South, which, with the consequence that the cotton that then they release onto the market means that the cotton growers in India, for instance, are getting very, very, very small amounts of money for their cotton, and they are extremely left very, very vulnerable for it. And I think that that those kind of subsidies are pretty wicked in terms of world fairness. How long they'll last, I mean, quite certainly in Europe now we are removing subsidies and letting the market find its own balance, and that feels a much more healthy way to go about it, because in the past we've had big subsidies into areas which have ended up with big surpluses of crops because people have just grown them because they will be rewarded for them whether they are needed or not. This has happened particularly with milk, particularly with butter and with wheat, although at the moment, because of the last couple of years of bad wheat conditions in the world, it's for the first time in a really long time that we do not have any stocks of wheat. We do not have any. The world does not have emergency stocks. The world is out of them. Going back to your, just remind me of the first point.
Overpopulation.
I'm someone who happens to think it's a bit of a red herring, overpopulation. If you look around the world now, it's kind of quite well known now that, say, European families are coming way down in size. In fact, almost all European countries are now under the 2.2 needed for sustainable, continual sizes being kept the same. And a lot of countries are down to 1.4, 1.5. Italy is the lowest. But going into countries like, again, with Africa and with India, say in India where people are starting to get more technology into their farming, the whole notion of having a family of six has become not what you want, because you had the family of six because you wanted three or four people to work on the farm. There's now no work on the farm, so what happens to them is they end up in the cities. And the same is true in Africa, and the whole migration to the cities, coupled with the fact that a lot of the central farming areas are becoming completely useless because of the levels of the drought, because of the changing weather patterns and the way that the rainfall comes, has meant that they can't farm and they're going to the cities. They are reducing families. The question of food is not so much that we haven't got enough, it is that we distribute it very badly and that we eat the wrong thing. I said it earlier, you know, if we wanted to eat like America, no way, we couldn't do it. I mean, we couldn't feed what we've got at the moment, let alone could we feed 9 billion. If people develop a kind of equity with food, and you know, one could say this being romantic and that in fact what it will lead to is a level of mass starvation, although one hopes that it won't, because it's perfectly doable. And people often throw the question of population in and say this is the thing that will caput it all. I personally don't think it is the thing that will caput it all. I think water will first and then oil, and then out of that we will wake up to a better level of sustainability. But I might be wrong. I might well be wrong.
Okay, the young guy with the microphone there now.
Good afternoon. Coming back to our continent, we've seen a problem in recent years. For example, in Brazil, which these immense investments from another seed company, which is Pioneer. who has been investing in Brazil for soy production in the Amazon.
Yeah.
And
you mean Cargill?
Yes. Well, I think it was Pioneer as well. Well, I'm not very sure of which company it is. My question is, isn't there a way, so with this program of producing your own food, which we could, at a European level, for example, seeing you have the resources, couldn't we produce in Europe seeds to feed your own chickens, and which is the purpose of the soy, and reduce the damage we're doing to the Amazon, which is, after all, the world's lung?
I'm not sure if I've exactly got this straight. Are you saying why can't we produce enough in Europe, say, to feed all our cattle?
If there's
it's about seeds, isn't it? Yes. Talking about, yeah.
Because soy seeds in the Amazon are in Brazil are mostly used to feed the flocks of chickens.
So could Europe produce its own seeds for its own animals? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, in a healthy way, for example, as not to damage the Amazon rainforest, which...
So I think he's saying that could Europe produce the seeds that it would for its own animals and therefore not rely on seeds from other parts of the world?
Well, no, not at the level that we eat meat at the moment. 70% of the cereal crops grown in Britain do in fact end up in the stomachs of animals rather than directly coming to feed us. But that in a consequence has a knock-on effect, which means we then import a great deal. I mean, what's kind of happened in the food world is that things have sort of been shuffled out of one country into another. So a lot of countries have become, I think, weakened in terms of their own food security. I mean, I was in Grenada not that long ago, and it's the most fertile place you can imagine. I mean, all you need to do is really chuck things out of the window and they'll grow. And yet, and this is a country where you had breadfruit and cassava were the main, were the staple foods. And now it is that none of that is grown there. Most people even don't even know how to cook it. And they import wheat from the Canadian prairies because it was found that actually it was a really good idea that you could grow nuts. And the Chinese bought all the land so that they could get nuts from there. So you've sort of just, you know, made this massive distortion. And that's hence why we come and get, it's not even just Great Britain. I mean, for instance, most of the European pigs now, and indeed pigs for the world market, because of campaigners in America getting a lot of the really horrible industrial pig farms out of America, they moved them into Poland, where the laws are extremely lax and the bribery is very, very efficient. And now, you know, there's tremendous health problems happening because they're very near pigs. And all their food, none of that food's grown in Poland. All of that food comes straight out of the Amazon. So you are having to unravel a great deal to do that. And at the moment, for the world food systems, it's the cheapest and the best way to get it is to go in and deforest, both in Brazil and in Indonesia, where the same thing, it's soya and it's palm oil, mostly palm oil in Indonesia, but masses of soya for feeding animals. And as our demand for animals' meat grows, so countries will be just completely incapable of producing enough meat, feeding enough meat. It's very intensive how much you need. You know, cow needs a lot of grass if you want to feed it nicely and it tastes nice.
Well, we've come to the end of our hour on that note. We started with cows and ended with cows. Thank you for coming. Thank you for listening. Thank you for asking questions. And please join me in thanking Rosie Boycott.